we should be forward-looking today. I don't want to get in a position where we're commenting on the substance of the NIE. We in the UK have learned a thing or two in the last few years about the way we handle intelligence material in relation to WMD subjects. I see my French and German colleagues smirking, showing that there are limits to the extent of E3 solidarity. But I wanted to talk a little bit about where we head in terms of policy. I'm also conscious that, as Patrick said, there's already been much detailed and excellent analysis of the NIE, not least by Washington Institute scholars, but the press has been full of other similar analysis over the last week. I think if I were to summarize, the emerging consensus here, and certainly in our own capitals, was that the way the NIE was initially reported by the US press, which was very different to the way it was reported by the UK press, was a little bit misleading. And I think as the debate has settled down, there's a consensus that Iran's nuclear program remains a great international concern, not least because Iran continues to openly develop two of the other three elements which are essential to producing a nuclear weapon. That's to say, an enrichment program, which would in time give it the ability to produce fissile material, and a missile program. In the case of the enrichment program, missile programs, they're proceeding in defiance of unanimously adopted Security Council resolutions. Finally, I think the other element of the threat is that even if we take the NIE judgment on that work on weaponization was suspended, the NIE itself says that work could be resumed at any point. So we regard the threat as a very serious one and one that we need to keep engaged on. If I can just look back for a minute, I think it's worth sort of reiterating that our policy, and certainly the policy of the European Three, towards Iran's nuclear ambition has never really been based on concern about a weaponization program. Our policy has been informed by intelligence, but it's not been based upon highly sensitive intelligence material, which we can't share with anybody. Our concerns about Iranian's intentions with its nuclear program have been based on two main points. Firstly, the nature of that program, in that Iran seems intent on developing technologies that would give it fissile material, despite having no economic rationale for doing so. It's worth reminding ourselves that Iran only has one civil nuclear power plant, Bushehr, not yet commissioned, but the Russians have offered a lifetime supply of fuel for Bushehr. As part of the various offers we've made to Iran over the years, we've offered them legally guaranteed supplies of nuclear fuel in the event that, for political reasons, Russia would just suspend that. And finally, it's worth noting that even if Iran develops the capability to produce nuclear fuel at Natanz, which will take time, it couldn't be used at Bushehr anyway. I defer to more technical people around the table, it needs to be fabricated in such a way that it could be used at Bushehr, which the Russians would never allow. So they have no economic or civilian rationale for trying to develop Natanz at this point. We shouldn't forget that they're also trying to develop proceeding with work on a heavy water reactor at Iraq, for which they presented to date no convincing civilian rationale. The second reason we've had concerns about Iran's nuclear program is that it concealed those elements in contradiction of its obligations to the IEA and the NPT. And 4 years after revelations were made about the extent of the program at Natanz and Arak, they've still not been able to resolve some very significant questions about their past activities, which raises further doubts about their intentions. So our case has been based on a series of evidence, which has been systematically documented in reports by the IAEA in Vienna. IAEA investigations over the last 4 years have revealed other troubling aspects of past work on Iran, which could be linked to weaponization, including the discovery of the extent of their links to AQ Khan, who, as you all know, helped develop the covert military programs in DPRK and Libya, and who, to my knowledge, has no particular expertise in the capability to produce electricity. There have been discoveries of various documents, a uranium casting document supplied by the AQ Khan network, which certainly our technical people in London say has no use other than for a nuclear weapons program. And Mr. Larijani tried to laugh this off, saying this was the sort of information you could find on the internet. Well, that may be true, but as far as I can remember, the document was provided in 1987 when the internet didn't exist. And if they had nothing to hide, then why did they refuse to hand it over to the IAEA for so long? And there are various other elements, I'm sure that Nicolas and my German colleague will talk about some of the reasons we have grounds for suspicion. But I think the important point to restate is that our concern has not been based upon intelligence evidence. So in policy terms, post-NIE, our concerns remain. Our principal policy objective is to prevent Iran acquiring the capability to produce fissile material. What the US government is now referring to the long pole in the tent. I'm not entirely sure what that American phrase means, but I rather like it, and I repeat it. But I think in policy terms, our operational conclusion is we need to keep going with our twin-track approach. In the short term, we need to maintain and increase the pressure on the regime in Tehran. We need to keep working with the Russians and Chinese for a third Security Council resolution to demonstrate to Iran that she is not in the clear post-NIE, and that international concern remains strong. And we remain of the view, and I think that view is shared by the U.S. administration, that the international consensus that comes from unity at the Security Council remains a powerful point of pressure on Iran in its own right. I think we also need to look at other ways of increasing the pressure. As Europeans, we've been discussing this among ourselves. Discussions continue on what form that will take, whether it be political or economic pressures. There's a major meeting of European leaders tomorrow, the European Council, which I expect to issue some robust conclusions on the need to continue working on a twin-track strategy. And I think, as we're on the record and as we're here, I think it's worth remembering that the European Union has already gone considerably further than Security Council resolutions 1737 and 1747. We interpreted sort of advisory language on visa and travel restrictions as a mandatory ban. We banned the export of all goods on an, or imposed a legally binding embargo on the export of all goods on an EU dual use list. And we also sanctioned a further 24 individuals and companies beyond those listed in the Security Council resolutions. So I think sort of more complementary action of that sort will be taken by the European Union at some point. The timing still to be agreed. Looking ahead, I think we will need to think creatively about the other element of our strategy, how we engage the Iranians, how we reach out to them. Over the last 2 years, we've had established a good record of discussing this as six. Javier Solana is sometimes portrayed in Washington as the European Union representative on Iran. He's not. He's the chief executive for the E3+3 process. Everything he says to the Iranians is agreed with Paris, Berlin, London, and Brussels, but it's also agreed with Moscow, Beijing, and Washington. We'll need to be creative. At the heart of a twin-track approach, I think, is a calculation that the Iranian system as a whole is susceptible to a rational cost-benefit analysis, and that we can persuade enough people within the wider political system the costs of their current approach are too high and that there's a better option available to them if they were to change course. I think in the first quarter of this year, for a combination of reasons which I won't repeat here, we saw a real public and private debate in Iran about the direction the regime had set them on. There was real nervousness that about the prospect of further action at the Security Council, real nervousness about that the country has embarked on a confrontation. I think some of that debate has gone out, has diminished over the last few months, mainly because the regime cracked down on any sign of public dissent, but also because the diplomatic process has stalled to a degree. But I think that we have a window of opportunity in the next few months. We have very important parliamentary elections in Iran at the beginning of March, a time when the Iranian political system will open up. And we have a chance, if we're creative through our policies, to stir that debate and see if we can strengthen the hands of those who are perhaps more inclined towards a negotiated solution. So reading the political straws in Tehran is a complicated business. I would say, I think in the last few weeks, we've seen signs of a few straws to give us some comfort. I think there's been a sharp increase in the level of noise in Tehran in the last few weeks. We've seen some quite striking criticism of the president. A lot of this is economic-based. We see daily criticism from elected members of parliament. We've also seen criticism of the president's policies from the new head of the central bank, who was, interestingly enough, an Ahmadinejad appointment. I think that reflects a wider unease about the impact of inflationary policies at the sort of street level, where you've created a bottom-up pressure. You've also got a real nervousness among business community and many members of the regime and the technocrats about the impact of sanctions are having on their own business and the potential impact that sanctions, in particular on the drying of a foreign investment, will have on Iran's future economic prospects. But there's also political criticism. Former President Khatami took a big swipe at Ahmadinejad, I think over the weekend, criticizing him for cracking down on social freedoms. We've seen some signs of difference within the regime over foreign policy. We might talk during questions about why Larijani resigned, but I think the fact that he did resign was an evidence that there's clearly a difference within the regime over how best to pursue nuclear policy. We've seen the former negotiator Hassan Rouhani, another significant figure, currently not holding an executive office, but a significant figure within the regime, popping up and criticizing Ahmadinejad's handling of the nuclear diplomacy, saying, you know, because of your diplomacy, you've even got the fringe, threatening military action against us. So, and then I think just one other straw in the wind. A couple of weeks ago, we had President Ahmadinejad giving a major speech saying that he was about to expose some traitors who were challenging Iran's policy in the nuclear file. And 2 days later, an Iranian newspaper popped up and rather unusually published an editorial saying actually sanctions were really hurting and perhaps suspension really shouldn't be an Iranian line, a red line. I don't want to overstate the significance of all that. I think we are talking about straws in the wind, but from straws are bricks made. I think the challenge over the next few months for our diplomacy is to encourage that debate, exacerbate it. Politics in Iran can change very fast, and when the politics change, policies can change. So we need to sharpen our sticks. We need to, through UN and EU sanctions, I think on the other strand of policy, we need a much greater public diplomacy effort. We need to clarify better the carrots that are on offer. The E3 plus 3 made a very generous offer in June 2006. I think we probably all agree that we didn't do a very good job of selling that offer to the wider Iranian public, making it clear to them that the sort of things that were on offer included the chance to develop a state-of-the-art civil nuclear power industry and significant economic and political benefits, including the chance to sit down with the United States for the first time and the lifting of U.S. sanctions in some areas. We need to be creative about that. We'll also, as E3 plus 3, need to think about how we next engage the Iranians and in what form. There's a bit of a misnomer that a misconception that we don't talk to the Iranians very often. In fact, we're talking to them all the time. Solana had his last meeting, I think, 2 weeks ago. Once we have another Security Council resolution behind us, we'll want to return to dialogue with Iranians, try and see if we can coax them back into negotiations. All that needs to be carefully crafted. It needs to have an impact, political impact, inside Iran, and we need to demonstrate clearly through our continued outreach that it is Iran who is the unreasonable party. We'll perhaps talk in questions about whether or not the NIE has changed the international dynamic. I think just a few personal observations. I'm not sure it's changed the international dynamic in Europe. There's lots of speculation that it will weaken pressure for sanctions. I think those arguments work both ways in some countries. There's always been a concern that if you were to proceed with sanctions, it will lead inevitably to military action. The perception that perhaps the military option has been reduced might encourage some countries, certainly in Europe, to consider sanctions. And I think we need to see how the dust settles in Iran, too. I think it's a misconception that everyone in Iran is thrilled with the NIE. I think the more thoughtful people recognize it doesn't give them a clean bill of health. And I think that the argument that the Defense Secretary Gates made when he was giving his speech in Bahrain the other day, that people can't pick and choose which conclusions of the NIE they wish to believe, actually resonates inside Iran, and I think it resonates elsewhere in the world. So, looking forward, I think we're on much the same track as we were 2 weeks ago. The NIE has created a lot of noise in Washington, created less noise in our own capitals. In a sense, we think it validates the approach that we're on. We will continue with that approach, but we will need to be more creative in the new year as we try to put together a policy that will impact upon Iranian behavior. Thank you.